You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko manua tōku ingoa naumai harimai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Emmanuel, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producers Theo and Toby. Efi Akane coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party. I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the letter they sent to the National Party detailing the measures they'd give their votes to support Kiwis and conserve fuel during the Iran supply crisis. I also spoke to Danielle Legale, a co-founder of Sunday Blessings, about the day of action in opposition to the government's proposed move-on orders. Theo, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Leonie Morris from Te Wahi Wahine o Tāmaki Makaurau, the Auckland Women's Centre, on their petition to bring back Te Tiriti-based inclusive relationships and sexuality education in schools.
And Toby, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to theology expert Andrew Shepherd about religious rhetoric and Trump's war in Iran.
Hey, aha, o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tukupatahi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahai ana koutou te whakarongo ki anei, kōrero anō e pakehere rukiruki mā runga I te pai. Tukituku I irangi poho men haere ki 95BFM I rakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
The crisis growing at the pump is ramping up in seriousness as the conflict in Iran continues to escalate. This week saw US President Donald Trump make further threats to destroy Iran's energy infrastructure that is yet to be bombed, and in turn Iran continues to target Gulf states and block the Strait of Hormuz, preventing any exports from this critical global hub. This blockade is preventing over a third of the world's nitrogen fertilizers and a fifth of the global supply of oil and liquefied natural gas from leaving the region, while both sides' bombing campaigns are causing widespread destruction to infrastructure, which means we may not see a return of some oil and gas fields for years to come. In Aotearoa, the costs of fuel have been seeing steep rises, soon to be spread across the economy as everyone's back pocket is hit and attention is now being turned to fuel reserves, with fears we may see imports decline. To face the moment, the Green Party has put together a collection of proposals which they have sent to the in an official letter to the National Party. And between the two parties, they'd have enough votes to pass these proposals. They include support payments for those vulnerable to price increases and public transport subsidies to conserve fuel and windfall taxes on monopolies that are profiting from these times and cuts to criticised infrastructure projects. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, we dug into this letter, their proposals, and why the Greens are reaching out to the Nats. Good morning, Ricardo.
Morena.
I want to start our conversation today by talking about a letter that the Green Party has sent to the National Party proposing a raft of changes that we could be making in this current moment to address the crisis coming from Iran. Could I get you to introduce our listeners to what it's doing? What is it offering to the National Party?
The Green Party acknowledges that right now people need support, and people who are already struggling to make ends meet or were living week to week are some of the hardest hit by the increase in fuel prices and prices overall, which is why we wrote to the National Party to offer our votes for them to be able to pass through support packages that would reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, but would also give income support effectively to those who need it the most. This would include having free public transport, at least for a temporary period, to offer basically cash in hand support to cover the increased cost in fuels to those who need it, so families who earn the median wage or less, and also to support moves to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. These are measures that will support families on a weekly basis, but we'll also incentivize and support people to have alternatives to get around. We also acknowledge that rural communities and disabled people are particularly hard hit, so this is why we also supported them to offer our votes to basically reverse the cuts to the total mobility scheme, as well as offer support for transport routes in rural areas so that people can be supported and, you know, take buses should they need to take their kids to school and to or to work, etc.
Right, so a big focus on public transport and also income support. I want to ask off the bat how serious of an offer this really is. Do you feel like it's one that you feel the National Party is likely to take you up on, or was likely to take you up on, or was it more trying to say the Green Party is open for business, we're open to collaborate?
We're extremely serious about these proposals, and this is why we are going as far as to offer our votes to pass any legislation or support packages on a sort of emergency budget on this issue. Because right now, I would expect that we all should be looking at evidence-based solutions that will help those hardest hit. And I acknowledge that free public transport needs to also be met with an increase in frequency. But right now, these are some of the measures that we know will better support people. And public transport, as an example, is something that will particularly take the burden off rural communities, because a lot of our fuel use happens in our urban areas. And so the more we can support people in urban areas to take public transport in an affordable and frequent way, the more our rural communities also will be supported by us in urban communities using less fuel effectively. And so we hope that the National Party listens to this, but takes heed of a call and actually takes our offer, because we know that parties like the ACT Party are very unlikely to be supporting any measures that affect those hardest hit by the cost of living crisis.
Now, within the proposed measures was also proposals about how this could be funded. Could you speak a little bit about that?
That's correct. So one of the things that we've offered the government is for them to basically put an excess profit tax on big corporates that are continuing to make huge profits at the expense of everybody else. We've previously been calling for an excess profit tax on the likes of the supermarkets, for example, and this would be a good way to redistribute funds to those who need it the most. The National Party has long acknowledged that the duopoly and other corporations are making effectively excessive profits, and they're not, you know, they're losing the social license, which is why we think this is one intervention that we could put in place to channel support to those who need it the most. And I want to be clear that this does not take away from our ultimate fight for us to have a green-lit government come the election. But I think right now people want us to be collaborative as we have a fuel crisis happening, and that will exacerbate the cost of living crisis. And I think it is time for us to hit pause a bit on on the more partisan politics and actually try and work collaboratively to do things that we know work.
One of the other things I saw within the letter was a proposal to scrap or put on hold for now and move the budget away from a few of the roading infrastructure projects that the National Party has proposed and that the Green Party has been opposed to.
This is just simple fiscal responsibility. The reality is that this infrastructure projects the government is funding are extremely expensive, particularly per kilometre. And we've long said that if we wanted to build modern transport infrastructure that also makes us more fuel efficient, that there are better ways to do this. And investment in things like rail are actually far more economically viable. They help us reduce our reliance on fuel and make us more productive when it comes to the transport of goods as well. So we think that these projects could be put basically on hold or cancelled and redistribute that resource towards actually helping people get through this fuel crisis. Ultimately, what we need is a government that takes fuel efficiency seriously, that takes issues around reducing our reliance on fossil fuels seriously, and invests in modern infrastructure like rail to a degree that we have not seen before, because we're now facing the consequences of not having adequate rail infrastructure.
Now, the National Party has made a few changes, a few measures recently to try to address the crisis. Could you talk about how you and the Green Party are viewing those?
The increase to the in-work tax credit, which is what the government has announced, leaves behind young people with no children. It leaves behind parents with children who may be on income support, who may be caring, for example, for disabled children. It leaves out disabled people on the support of living payments, some of our hardest hits by the fuel crisis, which is why, while, of course, it's better than nothing, I think this government isn't actually doing targeted support to those who need it the most. We're talking about families that are being left out that were already struggling to make ends meet, which is why we go back to our call to actually put in place solutions that support people in poverty, but also, you know, the people, you know, the other commentators would have called it the squeeze middle. We can do both. There is enough in Aotearoa to support people in poverty and people who may be eligible for working for families. And we're really concerned that, for example, this package leaves out the 400,000 plus people who are relying on income support. And we think that this is wrong, particularly at a time of high unemployment, particularly high youth unemployment.
So they have given some tax breaks to some people, but not to these people that you feel are particularly vulnerable.
Well, the only people who will have these tax breaks are people who are eligible for the Working for Families package. And what that means is that you've got to be a parent who is in paid employment. Now, of course, parents in paid employment deserve a lot of support. But our point is that this leaves out a lot of parents who are not eligible for the Working for Families package. It leaves out young people who maybe facing high youth unemployment and maybe struggling to get jobs and applying for countless of jobs to begin with. And if we leave out those most affected by the cost of living crisis, we're effectively heading down the way of increasing inequality as a result of our response to this fuel crisis. It doesn't have to be this way. There is enough in Aotearoa to support everyone to be well while we handle this crisis. And this is why we're critical of the government's approach, which leaves out our poorest and everyday working people that may not be eligible for working families, which is the vast majority of the population.
As we wrap up our conversation today, Ricardo, I just want to talk about the crisis itself. We've been talking about the solutions that we might need to put forward to support Kiwis. How serious of a crisis do you feel like this is? And, you know, what could happen if we do not put in measures like this?
We should be working towards the best outcome, but preparing for the worst possible situation, which is why this government needs to act with far more urgency to put in support for low-income people, to actually start redirecting investment into projects like rail. And I am particularly concerned by the carelessness and lack of care for human life that Israel and the United States are showing. And that is costing the global economy. It's costing livelihoods. It's heading down a path of completely disrespecting international rules-based order. And I am particularly concerned that our government is asleep at the wheel and not taking this crisis with the severity that we should. Because at the end of the day, this represents a geopolitical challenge. It represents a challenge on how New Zealand chooses to align itself to the United States as they continue disregarding international rules-based orders. And it poses a challenge domestically when it comes to an increase in inequality, an increase in homelessness, an increase in unemployment that will be felt particularly hard in countries like ours that have become more reliant on fossil fuels as a result of government decisions. So we should take this crisis extremely seriously. And I know that everyday people are feeling anxious about this, which is why we're committed to putting in place solutions that actually support those hardest hit, but also puts in place infrastructure that actually makes us less reliant on fossil fuels.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me this morning, Ricardo.
Thank you very much.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March on the cost of living. Oh, pardon me. That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March on the letter the Green Party sent to the National Party on collaborating over the cost of living pressures from the Iran crisis.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
This is Porter's Heads with Chase the Tar. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beam. We'll be right back.
The visionary Kim Gordon is back with a record that tells you what to do on the packet. Play me, and we're happy to oblige because it's a banger. Tell me what you want, you have to see. Your mates on 95BFM Drive are giving away copies of the album all week to B-card holders. So tune in, turn on those Tardinger, and await your cue to enter. Play Me, the new album from Kim Gordon. Available now wherever fine music is sold.
Strange Universe and 95BFM are pleased as punch to present May Simonis, live at the Tuning Fork, Tuesday, June 16th, as part of Strange Universe Winter. May Simonis makes her long-awaited Aotearoa debut and is set to make the city swoon over her sumptuous blend of indie rock, bossa nova, jazz, and chamber pop. Strange Universe Winter, featuring May Simonis and so much more. See the stupendous full lineup and get tickets from banishedmusic.com.
If all you want this school holidays is backflips and ice cream, then you better listen to the 95BFM Kids Show this Sunday.
We have a family pass to the Dust Palace's enchanting circus show, The Ice Cream is Melting, to give away to one lucky B-card holder. So make sure you tune in for your chance to enter.
The Ice Cream is Melting at Ellerslie War Memorial Hall, March the 30th to April the 11th. Get your tickets now from iticket.co.nz.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, and advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
Arcade Radio. For all that and music from all corners of the globe, tune in to Arcade Radio, Thursday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. with Dylan Biscuit and Leon Aoki.
Arcade Radio. Only on 95BFM.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Before the break was Portishead with Chase the Tear. The Wire. The ongoing war between the US-Israeli coalition and Iran is a battle between three nations of three different faiths: Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Religious rhetoric and imagery has been deployed on all sides in order to arouse public support, with the Republican administration in the US making some less than subtle appeals to its evangelical Christian voter base. However, opinion polls show that the war continues to be unpopular in the United States, and while many evangelicals continue to support Trump, the administration's attempt to frame the conflict as a holy war has been a cause of confusion and annoyance for other sections of the American public. To help us understand the complex relationship between war, faith, and American politics, I spoke to Dr. Andrew Shepherd, Senior Lecturer in Theology at the University of Otago. It's been argued by many critics that the Trump administration has failed to build the kind of public support for the war with Iran that previous administrations were able to gather in preparation for previous overseas conflicts. Recent polls show that support for the war is low and that the American public is generally confused about the aims of the conflict. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has more or less stated outright that the United States was simply following Israel's lead in attacking Iran. So how does the US government's messaging around the war in Iran differ from other conflicts, and is this difference more plausibly explained by a lack of preparation or a deliberate change in strategy?
I think the confusion around messaging is because there's confusion itself about what the actual aims of the war are. And in that sense, there is no strategy. Rubio has said, you know, that essentially more or less there's a sense in which they feel like they've been following Israel's lead, but on the other hand, we hear the idea that they're involved in regime change. You know, so there's a set of sort of different reasons being given for the war. It's to stop the ability for weapons to be rained down on the states, even though obviously last year they said that they had obliterated the Iran nuclear program. So the fact that there's confusion is the confusion itself of the administration. And probably the better question to ask is there any strategy, or is this purely essentially a distraction? Is it the hubris of an administration which has seen the ways in which they can remove the head of Venezuela and create sort of a puppet regime there, and sort of the hubris that one can do the same thing again in Iran, which obviously if they had read history, they would have understood that that's not going to be a simple task.
So your main area of expertise is in theology, correct?
Yes, correct, yeah.
2 weeks ago, a rather bizarre scene played out in the Oval Office in which a large group of pastors gathered around President Trump, placed their hands on him, and prayed for his success as the press took photographs. Meanwhile, Marco Rubio has stated that Iran is run by, quote, religious fanatic lunatics, as part of his justification for dismantling that regime. Is there a risk that the American public is beginning to view their own government as being run by religious fanatic lunatics?
One would hope that there's an awakening that is indeed an element of that. I guess one of the questions depends on how one defines religious fanatical lunatics. A bit like the term sort of terrorist. One person's terrorist is another person's is a freedom fighter, and one person's religious fundamentalist lunatic is another person's faithful adherent to a faith. I think largely within the states, or certainly within pockets of the states, within sort of very conservative forms of what has become sort of evangelicalism, though recognising even that term itself is open to debate, the use of that term. But certain pockets of Christianity certainly are supportive of Trump. But more broadly, I think there is some real disquiet leading through to sort of just complete disdain about the sort of the ways in which the actions are tied up with sort of theological justifications and religious language.
You mentioned the term evangelical. For those who don't know, could you just give us a brief explanation on what that term means?
Well, nowadays when we use the term, almost it's simply used always pejoratively. So, an evangelical, and it's just immediately used as a way of a shorthand of speaking about North American evangelicals and sort of essentially MAGA supporters. The word has a much longer history. I mean, through to, people like William Wilberforce, who was involved in the abolition of slavery in the UK and in the 18th and through into the 19th century, they were British evangelicals, were part of a group called the Clapham Sect, who were highly influential in terms of humanitarian forms of a Christian faith that then was engaged with social justice issues, etc. And that moves right through into the sort of the 20th century. So, for instance, in the United States itself, evangelicals, or those who regarded themselves as evangelicals using that label, right through the 1970s were strong Democrat voters. They were very involved in supporting Jimmy Carter and therefore deeply focused on environmental concerns and justice concerns. What happens from about the early 1980s is that sort of a conservative form of the Republican Party basically works out a way to build a relationship with this evangelical church, which is also, as well as being concerned with environmental and justice issues, is also concerned with sort of more moral issues, questions of abortion and sexuality. And essentially what happens is a marriage begins to form there, a marriage of convenience. And those sort of more, you could say, personal moral issues around sexuality become the defining feature of evangelicalism. And then essentially what you've therefore had over the last 40 years is a cementing of that relationship between the evangelical church and the sort of the very conservative wing of the Republican Party, and then through into MAGA.
Okay, and could you help me understand the connection between North American evangelical Christians and Israel? There seems to be a view that support for the state of Israel among North American Christians is linked to a belief that the return of the Jews to the Holy Land is necessary to fulfill a biblical prophecy and bring about the end times. How widely subscribed is this kind of view among American Christians, and is there a sound biblical basis for it?
Good questions, Toby. Again, you could give a whole lecture on this. Again, what you're talking about is sort of the 1960s, 1970s onwards, forms of American evangelicalism in terms of the way in which they read the Bible or interpret the Bible, particularly after 1948 and the coming into being of the State of Israel. They start reading the biblical texts in political ways of saying, oh, well, this is a fulfillment of a prophecy. And so you begin to get essentially the rise of sort of a form of a Christian Zionism here. And that has always been present within forms of American evangelicalism, but again has become stronger and more strident in the last 40 years. So that again, now to be an American evangelical is to have sort of certain stances or postures, whether that be on abortion, whether that be on sexuality, or whether that be on being pro the modern day state of Israel. Again, that isn't necessarily shared across the Christian spectrum, either in North America, but also more broadly. But in the States, it's obviously it is a very strong voice.
Just to give an example of that kind of thing, recently the Military Religious Freedom Foundation has been inundated with complaints from US military personnel who say they've been bombarded with apocalyptic Christian messaging from their superiors in the army. There have been reports that a combat unit commander speaking to his troops cited the imminent return of Jesus Christ as a justification for the war with Iran, saying that President Trump has been anointed by Jesus to light the signal fire in Iran to cause Armageddon. As an expert in Christian theology, what do you make of those kinds of statements?
Well, I mean, I think I'm like your listeners. I mean, I find it deeply, deeply distressing. But again, this is always the case through, you know, Christian history. It's, and in fact, any religious histories, which is, you know, you, one way to read this would be this is what happens when lunatic fringe, in a sense, begin to create a theology which justifies their actions. So, I mean, yeah, it's deeply worrying that you have, say, Mike Huckabee, who more or less announces, well, Israel should be just able to take on the whole Holy Land because this fulfills a prophecy. And then you have Peter Hesketh, who's now the Secretary of War, who has a sort of apocalyptic idea of an end of age. And then you had, you know, you had funders like Peter Thiel, who from Palantir, who sees the sort of the moment that we're in a culture war as some sort of great clash of civilization. There is always recognizing that, that Christianity, like any religion, is a broad tradition. It doesn't play well when we sort of create this sort of monolithic understanding that sort of this is the mainstream. It's better to understand this as sort of on the fringes of what is mainstream Christianity.
That was Professor Andrew Shepherd from the University of Otago.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
Back in 2020, two new guidelines were introduced to support schools in teaching relationships and sexuality education. The guidelines were introduced by the then Associate Education Minister and New Zealand First MP, Tracy Martin, after reports from the Education Review Office showed inconsistencies in how schools taught the subject, alongside significant gaps. The new guidelines brought greater emphasis to sexuality and gender diversity, Māori and Pacific views of sexuality, the use of digital technologies, and information about relationships and sexuality education for disabled learners. However, the current government scrapped these guidelines as part of a coalition agreement with New Zealand First, who campaigned on removing the guidelines, which they called woke gender ideology. The new proposed guidelines for relationships and sex education are significantly different to those introduced back in 2020. For this week's Get Action, I spoke to Leonie Morris from Te Wahi Wahine o Tamaki Makaurau, the Auckland Women's Centre, on their petition to bring back Te Tiriti-based inclusive relationships and sexuality education in schools. Leonie Morris, kia ora. I think it would be helpful starting off just to give us a quick recap of the many changes that we've seen in this area since 2020.
Yes. Well, we used to have comprehensive Te Tiriti-based RSE that was brought in by the Labor government. Unfortunately, this government has got rid of that fabulous RSE and is now looking to bring in a very restricted version of RSE. In fact, they're not even calling it sexuality education, they're just calling it sex education. And it's actually very, very poor quality that they're wanting to introduce. It's basically racist, sexist, homophobic. It's appalling.
So what spurred the scrapping of the new 2020 relationships and sexuality education guidelines and created this new initiative to come up with a completely different relationships and sex guidelines?
We see it as purely ideological. Instead of drawing on expertise, it's just drawing on their own racist, transphobic and homophobic ideology. And it's really important because RSD done well is our most significant tool of violence prevention.
So what would you say are the main issues coming in with this new set of guidelines for teaching relationships and, like you mentioned, sex rather than sexuality education?
When people talk about sex education, they're basically talking about teaching children and young people the basics of the biology of sexual relations. We're talking about sexuality, that's all more about feelings, communication, young people understanding what healthy relationships look like, relationships built on respect, communication and equality, and how to recognise warning signs of coercive or abusive relationships.
Right, and one of the other kind of big concerns with this new set of guidelines is that it takes a very monocultural approach to relationships and sex education. There's quite a Eurocentric Pākehā kind of normative focus inherent throughout it. Is there any mention of, in pointing to concerns with this aligning with Te Tiriti, but also our very diverse and multicultural society that we live within, are there any indication of any even just nods towards other cultures within these guidelines?
There's very little, and that is very harmful. Quality RSE for rainbow and gender diverse young people in particular, seeing themselves reflected in what is taught can significantly improve their mental health outcomes and reduce their feelings of isolation. And of course the same is true of Māori and other ethnicities. It's so important that they, you know, adolescence is a period of significant identity development, and having a space to learn about relationships in a safe, structured way supports emotional resilience.
Yeah, and I think one of the main critiques that groups like New Zealand First have been raising with the original RSE guidelines was that concerns around that we shouldn't be teaching children about sex, sexuality, gender identity, relationships, and so on, because it's simply not a part of their lives at such a young age. Is there any truth to that? Is there any evidence that backs that claim up?
No. And the fabulous RSE guidelines that we had, they were all age appropriate. They had different curriculum and topics to be discussed in different ways with children and young people of different ages. So what they're doing is simply forcing their reactionary ideology on the whole of society, really. And people will suffer from that. It'll increase the risk of violence, particularly for groups the government is targeting for discrimination, such as rainbow communities and Māori communities. But it will also increase the risk of violence for everyone. We will have a society with much less emotional resilience if we adopt the proposals the government is suggesting.
Yeah, and looking at Inside Out's submission on this, which is linked within your petition as well, I can see that they've pointed to things like how kōrero around genitals and bodies begins at around age 5. However, mention of intersex differences doesn't actually begin until young people are around 14 to 15 years of age. I mean, that's another example, right, of kind of locking in this othering of people who exist outside of this very heteronormative, Pākehā-centric worldview.
Absolutely. And including discussions of these topics is affirming for people with different gender identities, sexualities, ethnicity. It can significantly improve their mental health and reduce their feelings of isolation.
Yeah, and another example is that introduction to discussions around menstruation and the menstrual cycle is beginning at about year 7. However, like Inside Out have pointed to, about 6% of young people will be menstruating by the end of year 6, which runs the risk of having a lot of young people not knowing what's going on with their bodies when it's happening, which I can imagine would be quite distressing.
Absolutely. Very, very harmful. And this whole curriculum that they're suggesting is very harmful. Quality RSE in schools, access to accurate information, becomes unequal if you don't have quality RSE. Then you're depending on what a young person's family is able or willing to discuss at home. So school-based RSE levels the playing field, ensuring all children receive a baseline of knowledge regardless of their background.
So what would you say the mission of relationships and sexuality education, what would you say that mission should be?
It should help young people understand what healthy relationships are like. It should give them emotional resilience, the ability to understand emotions, to communicate positively and to affirm their self-worth.
So looking forward, would a preferred pathway be a return to the 2020 proposed guidelines, or would we instead be looking for something to be built from that foundation?
I think we need a return, reinstate the 2020 guidelines immediately, scrap this proposed 2026 curriculum and set up an ongoing expert-led process to keep improving RSE. It can always be improved upon. We need RSE that honours futurity and is led by people with genuine expertise in education, health and violence prevention. Please sign the Auckland Women's Centre's petition. You'll find it's an Action Station petition, and we want to send a message to both the government and the opposition that human rights are not optional. Support futurity rights, trans rights, gay rights and women's rights to bring back inclusive futurity-based relationship and sexuality education.
That was Leonie Morris from Te Wahi Wahine or Tamaki Makaurau, the Auckland Women's Centre, on their petition to bring back Te Tiriti-based inclusive relationships and sexuality education in schools. You can find that petition on the Action Station website or go to the bio for this interview on our BCast page.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
Scientists have finally found the clitoris.
The Wire.
The government's planned expansion of police powers to allow them to charge people for sleeping in public and begging has generated a lot of community criticism, accusing the government of targeting homeless people who they are not offering alternatives to rough sleeping. To protest these moves and show support for our street whānau, community groups across Aotearoa are organising a national day of action to protest against the move-on orders proposed by the government this Sunday. To discuss the move-on orders and the day of action, I spoke to co-founder of Sunday Blessings, Danielle Legelai, about the day of action and the government's proposed move-on orders.
My name is Danielle Legelai. I'm co-founder of the organisation called Sunday Blessings Tamaki Makaurau Auckland. I'm also a criminal barrister. I've also had lived experience of homelessness as well, and I'm a mum.
I want to start us off today by getting you to introduce our listeners to the Day of Action. When is it, and what are you hoping people can achieve?
Cool. So the Day of Action is happening on Sunday, 29th of March, 2026. There's different activations going on all around New Zealand, but in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, in Auckland Central, we have an epic activation going on that starts with a rally at 5 p.m. up at Aotea Square, followed by a hikoi down to the Alan Marvel Centre, where the people at the rally and the march will be welcomed on by our Akarana Māori wardens and approximately 200 of our street whānau and people experiencing extreme food insecurity who usually attend Sunday Blessings. Then from approximately 6:15 till 12 a.m. we have various activities going on in the Alan Marble Centre, which is at 2 Freyberg Place in Auckland Central. There will be Polynesian Panthers, there will be Kahui Te Kaha, who will be providing social support. We'll have, of course, Orange Sky there, providing showers and washing services. We're going to have members of the clergy helping with kind of table talks about what their views are with what's going on. We will have poster making, we will have a movie night, and we will be centering at every step of the way at the Alan Marble Centre our street whānau's voice and their well-being, and just standing with them as allies on the margin, saying that these proposed move on orders are paru and we don't want them and they will not work. What we want to achieve is a collective voice and a collective action to show our leadership that have proposed these orders that they are not okay, and we're prepared to stand up against them. And we're starting to organise and activate. Many, many groups will be down there, and it's going to be epic night.
Right, so from 6 till midnight, is that right? 6:15?
Well, so 5 p.m. is the 5 p.m. rally. Yep, so 5 p.m. is the rally at Aotea Square. That's going to be have quite a few speakers, followed by Hikoi, and Hikoi will be happening down the footpath of Queen Street. Really important that we say that, because we're going to be engaging with people who are actually sleeping rough during the Hikoi in a way that is not invasive, in a way that is shows tender love and care. And then at the Alan Marble Centre, that will go from 6:15 till midnight.
Could you talk...
A three-part situation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you talk about your view on these move-on orders? What does it represent, and what does it say about us as a country right now that this is what we're facing with, and also about the people who are coming together to say this is rubbish?
Okay. Well, look, the starting point is that this is not evidence-based. It is a knee-jerk reaction to people wanting to punish people for merely existing, people who are already marginalised, people who are experiencing a really traumatic situation, rough sleeping and being potentially arrested for sleeping or begging when they don't have anywhere else to go, is an absolutely disgusting move by the current leadership of our country. It doesn't work. Not only is it arguably a breach of human rights and a breach of Te Tiriti, it's also going to be something that clogs up our criminal justice system. And I just think it's a bad move on the ground. It's a bad move in the courts. And yeah, there's a lot of ways that we can try and prevent it, whether it's through submission, whether it's through activations like what we're doing, or whether it's through arming our street whānau with the tools that they need to ensure that they stay safe when they're outside.
In a personal conversation I had to someone who was sleeping rough recently, they were talking about how 501 deportees would receive a set amount of grant from the government when they arrived, but people who were in New Zealand did not receive that kind of stuff. And not to litigate those claims, but rather to talk about the arbitrariness that a lot of support you can get if you're rough sleeping or if you're in those positions. There's a sense that these move-on orders might be applied at the discretion of the police. And with that, that means inconsistencies. What does it mean to be adding this level of instability to people who are already facing a great degree of instability in their life?
Well, you've said a really interesting point there, the discretionary element of it. Now, we already know that the New Zealand police have, and this is a lot of research that's been done behind this, it's not me just name-calling, but they have acted in a way that is biased against Māori, against young people, against poor people, but in particular against Māori. So the discretionary element really bothers me. We're giving people powers that do not have the training to be working with people who are experiencing such hardship. That's something that's really gross. We also already have laws in place to prevent what we call antisocial behaviour, which is things that would be more closely more close to causing harm when people are outside. Of course, we don't want to see harmful behaviour going on, but the issue that I have with police being able to apply a discretionary test when they have a lack of training to be dealing with people who are forced to sleep outside during the day because it's very, very dangerous to be sleeping at night, or forced to beg because they literally, quite literally, don't have the means to connect themselves up to support from WINS, yeah, which would come in with the begging provision. I have a real problem with that. It's going to cause trauma, okay? People have a connection to a place usually because they find it safe for that moment in time. A soft version of the move-on orders already happens. So people who are sleeping rough outside already are feeling unstable and paranoid and, you know, really psychologically challenged because they don't know, any noise that comes along, is that going to be moving on? Are my things going to be chucked out? Am I safe here if I sleep here? So to add another layer to that, where people can be arrested and detained overnight and have to go to court merely for existing in a country that fails and has a breach against the human rights of providing a home is an added layer of psychological warfare, in my view. And these people have been experiencing trauma for many, many years, often intergenerationally. So I think it's disproportionate, of course, but it's causing more harm to an already marginalised and traumatised person that we, the people, have a duty of care to be looking after.
Could you sketch out for us the pre-existing legal environment that you mentioned there? Like, what were police powers before this, and what are they going to be?
So, okay, keep in mind that we haven't seen a proposal of the bill. Okay, so we've seen, if you Google move on orders, you can see a proposed bill which relates to people protesting. Okay, so I'm really, really, really keen to get a copy of the bill and scrutinise it. But we do know for a fact that two things, and this is just Paul Goldsmith's announcement, that they want to add begging and sleeping to be able to arrest if people don't move on from doing that. What we have right now is we have good laws in place to prevent antisocial behaviour such as blocking entranceways, public entranceways, fighting, going to the toilet in public, things like that. So it comes under the disorderly behaviour kind of banner, and you can get a fine or a maximum sentence of imprisonment, and it ranges for a whole raft of charges that relate to antisocial behaviour in public. And the main issue for me is that, because of course we do want to eliminate behaviour that is harmful, okay, in a way that is not disproportionate to the act. But the issue that I have is rough sleeping. Is someone sleeping, is that really considered harmful to the community? Is someone begging, is that really considered harmful to the community? And is that actually going to get to the core root of the problem if we arrest and potentially they get fined or potentially they go to prison for a period of time? The laws that protect us, such as the trespass laws, things like that, they are in place and they can be used. What I fear is that our leadership is prioritising the look of our town of our country for tourists over the needs of our communities, in particular our Māori communities, which I keep bringing up because I consider this a breach of Te Tiriti o Waitangi because of the disproportionate numbers of Māori who are experiencing homelessness. I've done a slide, some slides that I shared with the Rainbow Church on what all the current laws are that you can be arrested for in relation to antisocial behaviour outside, but the two main provisions that are going to be added is the begging and the rough sleeping, so sleeping in public, which is extremely broad. Who can be caught by that? Someone falling asleep outside, will they be moved on or will they be judged because of symptoms that police think are associated with being homeless? again, coming into that discretionary point. So, yeah, I'm annoyed and I'm angry.
All right. Well, we're coming to the end of our time. I've got a couple more minutes if you want to talk about your organisation, Sunday Blessings, if you want to introduce it.
Sunday Blessings is just a small community group that works for our street whānau on a Sunday and a few other days. We originally started through rescuing quality kai from around Auckland and redistributing it. We've got three core purposes: to reduce quality food waste ending up in landfill, to ensure our street whānau are not hungry on a Sunday night, and number three, we like to campaign for law and policy change that ensures that food is a human right. We allow students to come and do their Jiki Bedenbrewer with us. We are partners with heaps of awesome organisations and schools. We've been around for 9 years, and I'm slowly starting to move out of that space and handing it over to the EPIC organisation called Fair Food, so I can legal protections kind of space for our street whānau. But yeah, that's Sunday Blessings.
And do you have any final things you want to leave with our listeners, a reminder maybe about your event?
Yeah, at the event there's also going to be a submission writing space, and I just need to remind everyone that this law is just a proposal. So a soft version of the Move On Orders has already been happening using the provisions of the Summary Offences Act 1981 that I spoke about around disorderly behaviour, but this harder version that arrests for sleeping in public and begging, that has not even been made into a bill yet. So strategically, there's a few ways the public can get involved. You can start preparing yourself through practicing how to write submissions. So you can come down to our event from 6:15 at the Alan Marble Centre, or you can start at 5 o'clock at the rally and take the hui down to us. You can get educated and you can learn what you can do to help our street whānau who are actually already experiencing arrest now. And you can join groups that are already doing epic work in this space and just be part of the movement. But yeah, there's people have to remember that it's not in law yet. A soft draft version of the bill has not been shared with the public. So there will be a few steps before this bill actually comes into force, and there'll be different ways that people can help, whether it's through Parliament or whether it's on the ground or whether it's through recording every single arrest of our street whānau that you see and uploading it to 105. And this weekend on Sunday 29th of March at the Alan Marble Centre, there's going to be an education panel on that and what members of the public can do, what our street whānau can do to keep them safe, and just where this all is all at in terms of process.
All right. So 5 till midnight in Tamaki Makaurau on Sunday, this Sunday. Thank you very, very much for joining me, Danielle.
Not a problem. Thanks for calling.
That was co-founder of Sunday Blessings, Danielle Galay, about the Day of Action protest this Sunday against the Move On Orders.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
This is Now and Again by Eleanor Wyling. We'll be right back after this break.
Oh,
This has been Now and Again by Eleanor Wyling.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kororo mai ki matou mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap for The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Professor of Theology Andrew Shepherd, Te Wahi Wahine o Tamaki Makaurau, the Auckland Women's Centre's Leonie Morris, and Sunday Blessings, Danielle Legalai. Nei rā huki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.